Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up on today's program, The Pope and the People, a report on Pope Francis's Wednesday General Audience, where he stresses that God excludes no one and opens his home to all. Treasures of St. Peter's. On the anniversary of Michelangelo's death, we revisit the figure of this genius of the Italian Renaissance and another major contributor to St. Peter's Basilica, the Baroque sculptor and architect Bernini. And a marriage lifeline, with February being the month where the Church celebrates events to help reinforce the institution of marriage, we find out about a special program that helps couples whose marriage is heading for the rocks. As normal, we begin today's program with a report on Pope Francis's general audience, where he stressed that God excludes no one and opens his home to all. His remarks came as he continued his catechesis on the theme of Christian hope. Lydia Cain tells us more.
La speranza che ci è stata donata non ci separa dagli altri.
The hope that we have been given does not separate us from others, nor does it lead us to discredit or marginalize them. Those were Pope Francis's words at his weekly general audience in the Paul VI Hall on Wednesday, as he continued his catechesis on Christian hope, dedicating his audience to the theme, Hope Does Not Disappoint. The Pope underlines that God does not have favourites and does not exclude anyone, but opens his home to all human beings, beginning with the least. Hope, the Holy Father explained, is a gift of which we are called to become channels with humility and simplicity for all. During his catechesis and drawing inspiration from St. Paul, Pope Francis said that as children we were always taught that it is not good to boast. Yet St. Paul surprises us by twice telling us to boast.
L'Apostolo Paolo ci sorprende in quanto ben due volte ci esorta a vantarsi.
This saint, continued the Holy Father, tells us to boast of the abundant grace we receive in Jesus Christ through the gifts of faith and love. When we do this, the Pope observed, we know God's peace, which flows into our lives and relationships. According to St. Paul, Pope Francis said, afflictions too can be something to boast about. For God's peace is not the absence of fears, disappointments, or suffering, he explained, but rather it reminds us that God loves us and is always with us. In remarks to Polish pilgrims on Wednesday, the Pope also recalled patrons of Europe, Saints Cyril and Methodius. Even today, he said, they remind Europe and all of us of the need to maintain the unity of faith, tradition, Christian culture, and to live the gospel each day. I'm Lydia O'Kane.
February the 18th marks the 453rd anniversary of the death of Michelangelo, a towering figure of the Italian Renaissance period, whose genius as a sculptor, painter and architect helped to create so many of the artistic marvels that we see today in the Vatican. But Michelangelo was not the only outstanding sculptor and architect who left a major mark on St. Peter's Basilica. Another was Gian Lorenzo Bernini, a master of the Baroque in the 17th century, who made a huge contribution to how we experience St. Peter's today. To find out some fresh details about Michelangelo and Bernini's works in connection with the Basilica, I paid a visit to St. Peter's in the company of Liz Lev, an art historian who lectures on Renaissance art at several universities here in Rome. She told me that the long and turbulent history connected to the building of this gigantic basilica tells us how ambitious that project was.
everybody from the beginning of church building was vying for the biggest church spot. And St. Peter's Basilica was the largest church in the world when it was completed in 1626. There was nothing to match it today. St. John the Divine in New York City is actually longer. And then there was a replica made in the Ivory Coast, which is made 1 meter bigger. So we do have churches that are wider, they're taller, they're longer, but nothing is quite like St. Peter's.
Absolutely not. It took 120 years, didn't it, to complete? And how many popes were involved?
I think it's 20 popes, 12 architects, 120 years, and the Protestant Reformation. So if something could go wrong, it went wrong with this project.
On entering the Basilica, we turned our attention, first of all, to Michelangelo's sculpture, known as the Pietà, which is on display on the right, close to the main doors into the church. Carved from a single block of white marble when the artist was only 23, this masterpiece depicts the Blessed Virgin Mary holding the lifeless body of her crucified son on her lap. I began by asking Lev to explain why Michelangelo's Pietà was so groundbreaking at that time.
Well, it was not sculpted for the place it's in today. It was sculpted for the old church, so it was in a small round room. We should have been 10 feet from the Pietà, and now you're a huge distance with a giant piece of bulletproof glass. Michelangelo was given a single block of marble, a basically year time limit, and the most interesting problem he had was the subject matter, because no Italian had ever sculpted the subject matter of the Pietà before. It's not even in the Bible. And so Michelangelo looked at what the Germans and the French, the inventors of the subject matter of the Pietà, did. And they looked at these bodies of Jesus with all of the wounds and the crown of thorns, all so people would feel pietà, or pity. And then he decided to do something different. He was from Florence, and anyone who's been to Florence knows that Florentines don't do ugly. And so Michelangelo decided to give us a Pietà in the form of a triangle where Jesus would be so beautiful that our pity would not be awakened by the suffering and the wounds, but it would be awakened by the loss of that beauty.
And it's also very naturalistic, isn't it? It's not just the Renaissance ideal of beauty, but there's a strong dose of naturalism.
The genius of the work is the blending of the two. On one hand, it's obvious that the body of Jesus comes from studying ancient sculptures, the articulation, the proportions. Jesus is perfect. But he also looked at a dead body in those unforgettable moments where the shoulder is up under the ear, the fold of flesh falls over the fingers, the muscles slump in the thigh. That's where you get that poignancy of a beautiful body, but that no longer is alive.
Is it true that it's the only bit of sculpture that was ever signed by Michelangelo?
Yes, it turns out that Michelangelo, after producing a work that was so groundbreaking and so new for the Jubilee year of 1500, was in there as the pilgrims piled in from all over the world and looked at what a beautiful sculpture is and said, "Who did it?" And he heard someone say, "Oh, I know the guy. He's Christopher Solari from Milan." But Michelangelo's not from Milan, not called Christopher Solari. And so he very famously came in, signed his name on the sash which crosses Mary's chest, and as they say, it's the only work he ever signed.
Michelangelo, that's not the only piece of work by a long chalk that he's done here in the Vatican. Let's look at the dome, the cupola of St. Peter. This was what he labored on in the last years of his life, didn't he? He didn't even get paid for it.
It's an amazing bracketing of Michelangelo's career. It opens in this image of Mary and Jesus of the Pietà, and it ends with Michelangelo, 70 years old, taking on a job he had been passed over and over again in 1545 when they asked him to complete the dome of St. Peter's Basilica, which will go over the tomb of the Apostle. He spent 19 years on that project. He died 3 weeks shy of his 90th birthday, and he did it for no money. He did it for, and I quote, "the glory of God, the honor of St. Peter, and the salvation of my own soul."
And he did a major redesign, didn't he, of Bramante's original design?
All plans for this church always involved a dome derived from the Pantheon, in which the dome would have sat very, very close to the body of the church. Even Bramante's plan still kept the dome, although there were little windows close to the body of the church. The problem is the Pantheon, albeit a perfect building, is a perfect pagan building. Everything about the Pantheon celebrates how men become gods. So Michelangelo spent 19 years recalculating the stress of the dome. So he could put in these 16 massive windows, look up above that dome, and those windows, a man comes up a pane and a half. They let in nothing but light. They support no weight. And you forget that's 137 and a half foot span of brick and masonry above your head. It's only 5 feet smaller than the Pantheon. It's only 6 feet smaller than the famous Dome of Florence. And yet Michelangelo's dome looks like it's floating.
And it still dominates Rome's skyline even today.
As a matter of fact, the design of Michelangelo did not only has called for the very tall dome, but the rounding of the sides. When you look to the left and the right, you see the sides curve out. And in his design, before they altered it in 1601, the form of the church was the head and shoulders of the church. It dominated the skyline because after the Reformation, there are the head and shoulders reappearing on the world landscape. Every church that was built after in its wake all had domes. St. Ignatius, the Church of St. Philip Neri, they all pop up like little heads standing around the leader, a beautiful and very distinct skyline.
At the Vatican, Bernini is probably most famed for his design of the colonnade encircling St. Peter's Square. But inside the Basilica, he also created a number of masterpieces, especially his massive canopy made out of cast bronze and positioned over the tomb of St. Peter, the first pope. Lislev tells us more about Bernini's canopy.
Well, like Michelangelo, Bernini will be working his entire life from 25 to when he dies at 82 in the environment of St. Peter's. His major works are accomplished here. 25 years old, his first job was essentially to do something to make Peter's grave more noticeable. Michelangelo's plan of the Greek cross had been altered in 1601 after Michelangelo's death, and now you have a church which is 187 meters long. You walk in the front door, you can't see the dome. How are you supposed to understand where Peter's tomb is? So Bernini built a 95-foot tall, 175,000-pound canopy in bronze, unmistakable from the front door. Incredibly difficult project, and yet there it is, immediate beacon to the presence of St. Peter and over the Pope's own altar.
Is it true that the bronze that Bernini used for the canopy was taken from the Pantheon?
It's actually a complicated story. The pasquinade, that which the barbarians didn't do, the Barberini did to poke fun at the Barberini Pope, who took indeed the bronze off the Pantheon, which is believed to have been used for this canopy. Believe it or not, it was actually used for something that I think most listeners will find more scandalous. They were used for new cannons for the Castel Sant'Angelo. However, remember that Pope Urban VIII Barberini was the pope for the 100th anniversary of the Great Sack of Rome on May 6 of 1527, in which tens of thousands of Romans died because the city was not prepared. During the time of the pontificate of Urban VIII Barberini, there was the 30 Years' War going on all over Europe. Rome was really the only oasis of safety, but with no standing army and no protection. So in a certain sense, this was a maneuver in order to try to protect the citizens, but as often citizens do, they found it more of an occasion to poke fun at the Pope.
But I gather the twisting columns didn't meet with everybody's approval, did they?
Well, you can imagine, after all of that work, building a three-story building in bronze inside another building, to unveil that and have people say, well, why would you use those twisting columns? A lot of people critiqued him for an architectural order that wasn't part of the Greco-Roman milieu. But what they weren't thinking is that the original columns 1,700 years ago that framed Peter's tomb, that were given by Constantine, the man who legalized Christianity, were identical to those bronze ones. They were smaller. They were made of marble. They couldn't be used in the new church because the new church is so vast. But Bernini was simply hearkening back to the same imagery pilgrims saw all those years ago and using the same imagery for the pilgrims of today. So the continuity of the church and also the exoticness, because Peter came from the East. He didn't come from Greece or Rome. He came from the East, and his message was exotic, just like the columns.
Let's turn now to the chair or throne of St. Peter, which is one of the precious relics inside the Basilica. I mean, this was claimed to have actually been used by the apostle, but that's somewhat unlikely, I presume.
Well, to begin with, the chair, the big bronze throne, is a reliquary. And inside is an ancient wooden chair which was used in papal coronations for many, many years. It apparently was fixed up by Charlemagne, so we mean means it was there in 800, and it was always considered to be Peter's particular chair when he was Bishop of Rome, and then it was incorporated into a larger monument.
But has anybody ever done any dating work on it?
The chair, the ivory additions into the chair date from the time of Constantine. And insofar as the wood itself, I don't remember ever seeing anything about the exact dating of the wood.
So that's lost in the mist of time, as you might say.
The chair was incorporated into that monument in 1657, so no one's been able to get at it since then.
Tell us something about the significance of this feast day of the Chair of St. Peter.
Well, the feast day of the Chair of St. Peter celebrates Peter's authority. Of course, it's a reminder of the magisterium, because the idea of Peter's chair isn't a king's throne, it's the cathedra, it's the teaching chair, and it's a reminder of Peter's entrusted with the deposit of the faith, a deposit that has been handed down from pontificate to pontificate to pontificate. So it alludes very specifically to the role the Pope has as teacher, following in the footsteps of Peter, also teacher.
And thanks there to Liz Lev, an art historian who teaches at several universities in Rome, for filling us in on just some of the most prominent treasures to be found inside St. Peter's Basilica. No flowers bloom, no wedding Saturday. February is the month where the church organises events and activities to help strengthen the institution of marriage, so often under threat in our secularised culture. In the report that follows, I found out more about a special church-sponsored programme that offers a lifeline to couples whose marriage is heading for the rocks. I just called to say I love you. In the US, over 40% of marriages end in divorce. That's the depressing reality borne out by the statistics, and it's an indication of the daunting challenges many couples face in trying to keep their marriage afloat in today's secularized and high-pressured society. Successful marriages, however, don't work on autopilot, at least not for long. They need care and nurturing, and it's especially vital that the spouses keep the lines of communication open between the two of them. How many husbands or wives argue frequently or feel frustrated, hurt or angry with their spouse? It's in situations like this that all too many couples believe that the only solution is to go down the path towards separation and divorce. But if married couples in crisis know where to look, help is at hand, and that help can often save a marriage. Originating in Canada, Retrovie is a program offered by Catholic couples and a priest to couples with marriage problems. Thousands of couples headed for cold, unloving relationships or divorce have successfully overcome their marital problems by attending a Retrovie program held in various countries throughout the world. Frank and Julie Laboda and Father Watt Bracken are American, and all three of them are volunteer international coordinators for Retrovie. Frank and Julie are married with four children and live in Madison, Wisconsin. They were pointed in the direction of Retrovie at a time when their own marriage was on the rocks and they were on the brink of divorce. They spoke to me about some of the reasons why their marriage was failing and how attending a Retrovie program helped to renew and heal it.
We had several problems, basically severe miscommunication and working opposite schedules.
So the communication issues led to us living quite separate lives. And as we worked different shifts in our work schedule, she was working days and I was working nights. And I began an affair with a woman I worked with and spent 9 months in an extramarital affair with a woman from work. Our marriage obviously went further downhill after that. And we were separated twice, and 5 weeks away from our final divorce when we found Retrovie.
And how did you find it?
My mother-in-law, Julie's mother, gave her an article from a magazine in the States about the program, and I called right away and registered us for the weekend experience.
And, was it really quite dramatic, the turnaround?
It was extremely dramatic for me, but I still had a lot of fear and panic and trust issues. But it gave us hope, because the couples that presented the weekend, the couples on the team, had been through misery even worse than ours. And we thought, if they can make it, maybe there's some hope for us too.
Now, the program consists, I gather, of a weekend experience. And then this is followed up with 6 to 12 week post-weekend sessions over a period of 3 months. Did you already find after that first weekend that you were discovering where things were going wrong or where to pick up the pieces? Or was it more of a question of learning to trust?
I think I knew where things were going wrong before, but I was always pointing a finger of blame at Frank. So the weekend helped me realize what role I played in the deterioration of our marriage. And then the follow-up sessions were integral in change because the post-sessions offered a chance to look more deeply at specific issues like trust, conflict, sex, forgiveness. And so that was really where the bulk of the change occurred throughout the post sessions as well.
I think for me, the weekend showed me what could be right about our relationship again and reminded me of the reasons that I fell in love with Julie in the first place and why we were together from the start of our relationship rather than showing me what had been wrong, because you could see that in our behavior with one another on a daily basis. But being able to talk with Julie and communicate with her on a whole different level over the course of that weekend and then the post sessions really showed me what was right about our relationship again.
Is it a prerequisite that for people who go to Retrouvai that both couples want to save their marriage? Because presumably if somebody's already given up on it, then it's hopeless.
Well, in our case, Julie had given up. This was her way of checking this one last thing off of her list of things to do before the divorce was final. So no, I don't think that both couples have to be committed to saving their relationship. As long as they're committed to spending the time on the weekend together, it could change their relationship just by being there together.
Each couple is asked to participate fully in the entire weekend and the follow-up sessions. But we would be lying if everyone who came said, yes, I'm 100% committed to making this marriage work. But over the course of the weekend, most of them change their minds and decide, yes, this is worth saving.
Father Walt Bracken is a Catholic priest from Chicago. And along with Frank and Julie, he gave his viewpoint about the strengths of the Retrouvai program.
Before I go into what happens on the weekend, I think what is key, and Frank and Julie have already mentioned this, is the hope that is given on the weekend. The couples come there with a sense of hopelessness with regard to their own relationship. By listening to the stories of other couples, they recognize the fact that other people can go through difficulties as well and come out of those difficulties on the other side with a great deal of hope for their relationship. I think that is the beauty of a peer ministry. Peer ministry allows couples to tell their story of their misery, their story of their hopelessness, and how they moved to a sense of hope. And this is done simply on the weekend by 3 different couples and a priest giving a series of presentations. And the idea is that the couple gives a presentation with a priest. After that, the couples who are participating in the weekend are given a question to reflect. They do some writing, they come together, and then they share with regard to this. And through these series of presentations during the course of the weekend, couples are able to communicate with themselves much more deeply. What we tell the couples on a Friday night is we are not there to solve their problems or to work on their problems. What we do is work on their communication so that once they begin to relate to each other and to communicate to each other, then they begin to solve their own problems on how they choose to solve them.
Now, I don't know whether you keep statistics, but do you happen to know roughly what percentage of the couples who come to Retrouvai do manage to save their marriage? If you have any idea at all on how successful this program is?
We've seen somewhere in the neighborhood of 75 to 80% of marriages at least continue on. Successful marriages, probably half. But they stay in their relationship up to 80% of the time.
That's quite a high percentage.
It's a very high percentage. And it's an experience that we see over and over on the weekend from Friday night to Sunday. I just called to say.
saying, I love you.
But what real-life anecdotes do they have of couples attending the Retrovi program whose marriage seemed doomed to collapse?
I can give you a story about a couple that we know. They were having difficulty. Of course, that's why they were on the weekend originally. They would do well after one presentation in their dialogue, and then they'd go back after another presentation, and they would find themselves arguing again. So on Saturday night, after the first presentation, they seemed to be doing well. After the second presentation, they started an argument, and they figured that it was no use. So they packed their bags, and they decided to leave the retreat house. Well, as happened, as they were driving out of the retreat grounds, there was a chain across the gate of the retreat house. And so there was no way that they could leave the grounds. So they turned around, they unpacked their bags, brought them back in to the retreat house. And long story short, I think this is God's sense of humor by having that chain across the gate, because this couple then continued to work on their relationship, not only on that weekend, but they themselves became very involved with Retrovi after this, to the point where they have given a good number of weekends themselves and a good number of presentations to help heal other marriages.
Do you know of any other particular anecdotes that stick in your mind?
Several, including us, but another couple that when we were presenting team on a weekend, this couple too was up and down and finally got in a huge argument and decided to drive home, and they had about an hour drive. They got about 10 minutes from home and decided it would be harder to tell their kids that they gave up than it would be to turn around with their heads hanging and walk back in the door of Retrovi. So they turned their car around and they came back and finished the weekend and completed all of the follow-up sessions.
And as far as you know, they're still together?
And as far as we know, they're still together and doing well.
Now, coming back, perhaps, shall we say, to the general state of marriage in society today, as you all know, particularly in Western countries, the rate of divorce is incredibly high. Why is that? Why do people give up so quickly, do you think? What more could the church and other bodies be doing to try to bring down that rate of divorce, of separation between couples?
It has a lot to do with the family. John Paul the Great was right when he said, as the family goes, so goes the world. And so Retrovi in the church, I think, is certainly moving in the right direction to curb the divorce rate.
I just think it's so hard, especially in Western countries. We're so bent on instant gratification. And if it's not what I want, I'm going to take it back or return it because it doesn't fit right. And that's carried right over into our relationships. It's not making me happy, so I'm going to return it and start over. And it's greener grass on the other side of the fence. And in most cases, in mine for sure, you know, in being involved in a 9-month relationship with another woman, it's no different. The problems are the same. You carry the problems with you wherever you go. So you can choose to stay in the relationship you started with and fight for your marriage and work on change in your own personal life and in your relationship, or you can continue to throw them away and start with a new one. And especially in the United States, we're at the point where our society says it's just easier to toss it aside.
That was Frank Laboda, and you also heard the voice of his wife, Julie, and of Father Watt Bracken, speaking about the marriage rescue program called Retrovi.
I love you, and I mean it from the bottom of my heart.
And that's all we have time for today. Thanks so much for joining us here on Vatican Radio. I'm Susie Hodges, and until next time, Laudato Jesus Christus.